Hello, welcome to another exciting and elucidating episode of the OmniTalk Ask an Expert series. I'm one of your co-hosts for today's interview, Anne Mazenga.
And I'm one of your other co-hosts, Chris Walton.
And we're the founders of OmniTalk, the fast-growing retail media organization that is all about the companies, the technologies, and the people that are coming together to shape the future of retail. Chris, I've got a show for you today.
Do you, Anne?
I do,
Pray tell the audience.
We've been talking to retailers and brands so much lately about how they've begun to use AI tools to help them be more productive. They've been talking about all the different use cases that they've applied this to. Everyone has a different answer, which I love.
Yes, they do.
Some people are using AI to determine the agenda for their weekly business review.
That's right.
All the way down to using AI to make real-time supply chain decisions. So the problem is here is that many of those retailers and brands are still trying to figure out if how they're using it is correct and if they are setting themselves and their companies up to do it responsibly and with the right security in place. So, Chris, we've called on two legal experts, which we've never done before.
Two lawyers in the house, Anne. Two lawyers. I can't believe we're doing this. Like, I don't know. We must be out of our freaking gourds, Anne. I don't know what we're thinking, but I can't wait for this conversation.
Without further ado, Chris, we've called on these two legal experts, Mary Newcomer Williams, Assistant General Counsel of Azure AI, and Michael Brick, Assistant General Counsel of U.S. Commercial Industries at Microsoft, to share some of the concepts and best practices that retail executives can consider when implementing new AI solutions so that they can get the most productivity for their teams in a compliant and responsible manner. So with that introduction, Michael and Mary, welcome to the show. Michael, you are just back, fresh off a trip. You're so inspired, I'm sure, right now to be up at 4:30 in the morning as New Zealand time to help our audience.
Excited to be here.
Excellent. And Mary, thanks so much for joining us today, too. Are you ready for this session?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us.
Well, it's great to have both of you. And just a quick note before we get started, before we get into it with Michael and Mary, I just want to remind everyone watching live on LinkedIn, you can ask your questions of both of them at any time via the chat session window in LinkedIn on the right-hand side of your screen. All right, well, let's get started, Anne. Are you ready?
Yes.
Let's do this.
Yes.
All right, so let's start off. Let's get to know each of you a little bit. We've never gotten to know lawyers on our show before, so this is going to be interesting. But let's start off. Talk about your roles at Microsoft, and especially what we're curious about to start is how have they evolved since Gen AI came into the fold? Mary, why don't we start with you? Why don't you have the honors here and go first?
Yeah, so I have been a lawyer at Microsoft for 18 years now.
Oh my God. Okay.
But currently, my current role is I am the lawyer for the engineering team that builds our Azure OpenAI technology, our Azure machine learning technology, and our Azure AI Studio. So you can think of those as our really core AI technologies that we provide at a platform level for developers to use when they want to build applications that leverage the capabilities of AI. So I work really closely with the engineers and I help them think about, you know, how we deliver these capabilities as a product to customers.
Mary, how long have you been in this position? Like, when did this start that you're specifically focused on these things?
Well, I've been working with AI for, gosh, at least 6 years or so. But
okay.
I started thinking about Azure OpenAI as a product in March of 2021. So
okay.
We've been thinking, but you know, a year and a half before it actually launched as a product offering when we had first done the deal with OpenAI. And then since that time, that work that I've done has evolved quite a bit. And now, you know, we have the Azure OpenAI offering, we have other Azure AI capabilities. And then we have the model catalog where we make third-party AI models available to give, again, developers lots of flexibility to choose, you know, what is the capability they're looking for and what, you know, what model provider are they interested in, that sort of thing. So I've been really seen a lot, especially the really fast pace of how quickly we're bringing out these different AI technologies from different providers. Yeah.
Right. I got to imagine there's a new challenge coming to you every day. It's got to make your job really interesting and fun too. So Michael, what about you? What's your background and how's your job changed since all this came into being?
Yeah. Hey, and it's exciting. Normally they don't let the lawyers on the podcast, right? So again, great to be here. Mary, I think I've been at Microsoft just about 18 years as well. So I hadn't quite appreciated that we start at the same time. So I lead a team of exceptional lawyers, and we support the account executives, our sort of commercial motion, our engagement with enterprise customers. Our team is spread out across the US, and we work on contracts, we answer questions. We talk a lot with customers and customers in particular now with AI. And I haven't been working with AI quite as long as Mary, but over the last year and a half, it really has become a full-time job. And a lot of that is, demystifying AI, talking to people, not just about headlines, but about how it works, what they should be concerned about, and, what they should feel comfortable and confident about. It's been a great journey.
All right. Well, that's a great segue too, Michael, because I plan to go to you next with this next question. But so I'm going to use Joey Tribbiani air quotes here, because I want you to explain, what does responsible AI actually mean? Like, how do you think about that? And what are you seeing at Microsoft at this stage in terms of what works and what doesn't in terms of the application of that term?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And, responsible AI really is a buzzword, out there.
Sure.
And we think of it as really a governance framework, right? It's a framework that companies, individuals can use both to develop AI, develop their own applications, and really think about how they use AI or integrate AI into their own systems or into their own use cases, really in a safe, compliant manner. At Microsoft, our responsible AI program developed, I think, over time, but probably going back to around 2016, 2017, and it's really founded on six principles. I think three of those six principles that I think of as foundational principles are fairness, transparency, and accountability. Mm-hmm. Fairness is pretty obvious, right? We want AI to be fair. We want AI not to treat individuals or groups, similarly situated groups, differently. Transparency is all about understanding the technology, knowing how it works. From a generative AI perspective, it's understanding how, the large language models are trained and how they, ultimately make decisions. It's also about, when is there a human in the loop? And that's mm-hmm. probably something you'll hear Mary and I talk about a bit. When is or when should a human be in the loop to review, the decisions or the AI processes? The third of the six principles that I mentioned is accountability. Ultimately, the technology, the AI, should be accountable to humans. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Microsoft has done is created and published the Responsible AI Standard. And that is a standard that our engineering teams use to develop AI. It's the questions, it's sort of the checklist that they go through. Again, it tells them when to check in with Mary and her team, right, for review, sort of like a privacy framework or a security framework. We now have the AI framework, which is integrated together today. So maybe final point it's, in simple terms, it's asking questions, it's identifying use cases, it's identifying, potential risks or issues, and then identifying mitigating factors to make the technology, again, work in a safe, compliant, ethical, fair manner.
Yeah, that's so helpful, Michael. And we're going to connect the audience to some of those resources, because everyone's really, that's what we hear from everyone we've talked to, Chris, is like, mm-hmm. they're still trying to figure it out. They're trying to develop the framework. And I think there's so many points where you need kind of a starting point or some kind of template to go off of, both from when you're developing your internal use of this, and like what your engineers are going to use as creating tools for internal use, but then also, from a marketing standpoint, from a, supply chain standpoint, all these places, how do you kind of set up how the standards and practices for how we're going to do this?
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Mary. But I was just going to say real quick, I'm a big believer in like leveraging the tools that already exist out there,
yes,
in the marketplace to develop your own frameworks. Like, why recreate the wheel? Which, knowing the retail industry as we do, retailers tend to try to do that because, yes, they think their own internal ways of doing things are so special.
Right.
But in reality, there's a lot of tools that you can leverage and benefit from that are already out there, especially in terms of frameworks for how to think about AI responsibly. But go ahead, Mary. Sorry.
No, actually, I was really going to basically make that point, which is that, at Microsoft, we, as I was explaining, I support a team that builds platform technologies. We make those available to customers, developers. We also integrate those into our own products. So we've built our own applications on top of our platform technologies, and we have learned a lot from that experience. And we've thought about how to structure these issues. And then we've flipped and made those resources available to customers. So, because we've had exactly that thought, which is, what have we learned and how can we share our own learnings out to, our own customers and frankly, others in the marketplace.
Yeah. And you personally have been doing it for 6 years. Whereas for most retailers, this conversation is pretty nascent. I mean, it's like, a year, year and a half old at best for a lot of them.
All right, well, let's go into, we promised the listeners that we'd go into four kind of use cases here where retailers and CPGs can start to apply responsible AI. And I want to start with the first one because it's near and dear to me and my background, and that's marketing. So one of the first things that came out, I feel like, when Gen AI really started to be applied inside retailers and brands is generating marketing content. Everything from product descriptions, generating images, personalization. What should the marketing teams listening be watching out for when it comes to protecting the work that they leverage Gen AI for in this case? And Michael, I'm going to go to you first on this one, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So generating marketing content is a really strong use case for generative AI. And it's one that we see a lot of retail customers using, but not only retail customers, across, all the different industry teams that we support. And again, when you're thinking about AI and it's really good to first identify, as we said before, your use case, right? And once you've identified the use case, and in this case, generating marketing content, as you say, it's good then to ask, what are potential issues that I need to think about? And so I guess breaking down, what does generating marketing content mean? Often it's generating text descriptions, mm-hmm. it's generating product descriptions, it's generating images, et cetera. The questions that then come from that we get a lot that we think are important to ask is, all right, okay, so I'm creating this marketing product, this what we call output content, right?
Okay.
And it's good to understand, okay, what is input and what is output content? So input actually is a legal term in our product terms. And input, as you can imagine, is what you put into the large language model, right? It's the prompt. And output content is that which the everything that comes out of the generative AI system. It's the output. And so the question that first comes again is, who owns that output content, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it mine, the creator? I'm the customer using, say, Azure OpenAI. I've created these product descriptions. And from a Microsoft perspective, what we've done is we've tried to be very clear is that Microsoft will not, try and take any ownership interest in that. We will not claim any ownership interest. So people always ask, if it's, you know, if it's, if I create it, you know, is it's mine, and absolutely you, you know, you can use it. I think the related question is, if I create it and say I put it into a marketing campaign, what if it infringes someone else's copyright, right? What if it's similar to what other customers, what other, you know, people in the marketplace have created? And what Microsoft has done to try and get our customers comfortable with using, again, generative AI in this use case is we offer what's called the customer copyright commitment. And that really is a defense obligation, right? And the way that it works, and this is laid out in our online product terms, which we can share a link to, is if a third party, you know, makes a claim against you saying that the output content that you've created infringes their intellectual property, say their copyright, we will defend you against that claim.
Okay.
One of the interesting things, I guess, also about generative AI, though, is it's really a shared responsibility. So yes, Microsoft will defend you against any third party claims. You know, as a user of the generative AI, you also have to think about, okay, what am I going to be doing with, you know, with it? Right. Do I have rights in the input that I'm putting into the generative AI system, right? Which will influence the output. So you as the user have to have, you know, the rights to use the input. Generative AI and whether you're talking about our Microsoft Copilot products or Azure OpenAI, you know, have systems in place, right? They have content, technical systems, they have content filters, they have meta prompts, which is another term to talk about. Meta prompt is a rule that you put in place that the generative AI system follows. And the meta prompt might be as simple as, do not return copyrighted material. As a user, you can't go in and disable any of that sort of technical functionality, which is helping to protect you, the user, and Microsoft as well. Those are really two of the key questions: who owns the output, will Microsoft defend me?
Right. Well, and it's similar to, I think, the things that, if I'm hearing you correctly, it goes back to when I'm creating a piece of marketing content, making sure that you still have to go through the same process. I must own the rights of the inputs that I'm putting into my generative AI tool. And then the outputs, then again, checking to make sure that, yes, I still have the rights to use this. Microsoft will help defend me should a third party come after me. But it's ultimately making sure that you're kind of planning ahead for all the places where this content could be showing up and appearing in the future, the same way that you would for, say, you know, licensing music or licensing an image in that way. Is that right?
That's right. And again, as I said earlier, you know, this is one of the areas where you really want to ask, you know, is there a human in the loop? When should the human in the loop, you know, insert themselves, right? And if you're going to be, you know, sort of publishing materials or using them externally, you really need to think about when that should be. If you would have, you know, reviewed content, you know, before it went out into distribution, you should ultimately still do that at some point in the process, even if you're using generative AI, you know, to create works to begin with.
So that's really interesting. So that is still the recommendation then. Like, if you're using it to create outputs, then you would say there still should be a human involved in the review process to the greatest extent possible. Mm-hmm. And so therefore it's more of a streamlining the workflow than really a positioning of like putting all kinds of content in the marketplace that you as a human could never do on your own or review on your own. It's more the former is that what I'm hearing in terms of how people should think about this, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really depends on the very specific use case, right?
And what you're comfortable with as an organization, too, most likely.
Yeah, that's right. And there may be a difference between, say, creating a product description, just to describe the new coffee cup, right? that goes up. Maybe there's less of a need for human review there. But if we're launching our new, you know, global marketing campaign, right? That's going to go, you know, wherever out on
in
the 15 internet,
languages or
in
something.
15 languages,
right,
exactly.
Yeah. Right.
And we should take a look at the image that's going to go with that.
That's going to go
with it. All, you know, aligned with.
And the translations and all that kind of thing. Yes, that makes sense. Okay, well, let's shift gears a little bit then. So we've also heard a lot of talk in the circles in which Anne and I travel around using generative AI, particularly to help the store associates to make their lives easier and more productive. So Mary, what concerns or watch out should retailers have on that front? What should people be paying attention to there?
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit first about the opportunity before we talk about the things to watch, because I think you made the point about that when Michael gave that example of generating marketing content, it was kind of, this is a emotion that we see today. And it's just a way of, like, you know, a little bit taking advantage of a technology, but kind of within the existing experience. But I think in the shopping environment, both in store and online, these LLM technologies, especially the language models, really provide an opportunity to really revolutionize the experience and change what the experience looks like. And the reason I say that is that these language models bring this ability to have automated conversational experiences, right? And so again, as you said, sometimes there'll be a human in the loop. Sometimes you really want there to be a more of an automated real-time experience. And, you know, these, for example, you could imagine, because the language models have this ability to understand and generate natural language. So you could say, next time I go look, you know, on a clothing retailer website, let's say, I don't have to go into it thinking, I'm looking for black pants and tailor my search and just get, you know, a list of output. I can put in, I'm working from home more often and I want comfortable clothes that still look professional on a video call. And I could get both a natural language descriptive response of why this set of product, you know, a product, you know, results, plus a natural language description explaining why this set of products is, you know, the perfect ones for the scenario that has been described in a natural language way. So again, that's a very, you know, interactive, conversational, personalized experience for the shopper. And you can have that online, or you could have that even in an in-store type of assistant. And maybe it's one that is like exposed, you know, it's a screen that shoppers can see and they're working with, and maybe it even has some audio capabilities and video capabilities. You're stitching together a bunch of different types of AI,
right?
Image recognition, language understanding, these sorts of things. Or it's more something that's available to the sales associate on like a tablet, and they can really, they don't have to translate the customer's natural language question into the right search. They can put the customer's natural language question right in there and again, get a kind of natural language response for them. So you can imagine a few different scenarios where that could come into play in the store or the shopping experience broadly. But then you ask, okay, then what are the things you sort of worry about? And especially again, when you would have worry about and then get out ahead of, right? Because we work with this all the time. And so we are not so scared by this technology, but there's lots of, you know, of course the articles that, you know, are written in a way that, you know, can make this technology seem pretty scary. But when you kind of know what you should think about and what your options are for mitigating the risks, you can look at it a little bit more, you know, deliberately and intentionally, and you know, navigate the space with a little more confidence, right? So when you imagine these sort of automated experience where you're delivering information to a customer about your product, accuracy is critical, right? You really want that response to be accurate. And so some of the technologies that are available to drive that are, there's a capability called, it's sometimes called data grounding, and it's sometimes called retrieval augmented generation, which now you can tell that I hang out with engineers when I use stuff like that. But if I explain the term, I think actually it is quite useful, because it refers to a process where when you're building out an application like this, let's say a chatbot, that the prompt, there's a process where in the taking in the natural language question, let's say in generating a natural language response, there's a step where a source of data is consulted and data is retrieved. So relevant data that's relevant to the question is retrieved from a designated data source. It augments the prompt, so it's added to the prompt that gets sent to the model. And then the model is instructed to take that into account in generating the response. So you get retrieval augmented generation or grounded, data grounded responses. And that, so when you think about it that way, where you say, oh, I'm not relying on a base model that only knows like what it was trained on the web, you know, in 2021 or whatever. I'm looking at the model for the language understanding and my own data source that I've designated for the factual information that's going to get conveyed to the customer in a natural language way. So you can take that retrieval augmented generation or data grounding, plus, as Michael already described, the meta prompt capability. You can include a meta prompt, which is like an instruction, a natural language instruction to the model that says, hey, make sure that when you generate a response, it's always based on data that you received, right? Like data that was submitted to the model. So basically, you can instruct the model to be accurate in its natural language responses. Again, that's an example of some technical capabilities that once you are aware of that, and then when you think about deploying those applications, you say, okay, this is the capability that I want to make available, and here's the mitigations that I'm going to include with my application so that I can be confident that it's going to work, you know, in a way. And then you might add another layer of technology there. You might add content filters because you want to make sure, let's say somebody does something obnoxious, they want your chatbot to say something offensive, right? You can add those content filters so that if the prompt includes offensive content, or even if inadvertently the model generates something offensive, that can be filtered out by content filters. So you have these layers of technology that you can implement into your application to, again, give yourself confidence that that the experience for your customer is going to be what you want it to be.
It returns the right result, right? And then it learns over time too. Is that correct? Like the way this works, like does the way you're describing it inherently mean that it's going to learn over time and get better in terms of its accuracy as well? Or is that a bridge too far that I'm making?
Actually, I would actually say that's a common misconception about.
Okay, great. Good to know.
That now they are trainable. You can train them to learn more over time.
Okay.
But training, like giving a model information that tailors it for a specific experience, or either builds it initially or tailors it for a specific experience, is one like technical activity. And then inferencing, or like the generating of responses, is a separate technical activity. So sometimes people get nervous when they hear about these big models. They're like, wait, everyone's using the same foundation model. Is your big foundation model going to get smarter based on my information? And then those smarts are going to be used to help my competitor. And that really doesn't happen, because the foundation models are trained in like one way, and then as they are used to generate, you know, their language understanding is leveraged, they aren't changing as part of that process. It has to be a separate training activity that happens with the model in order to change the functionality. Okay. So customers can also fine tune some of these models for their own, to like recognize their own language. But what they're seeing is, in a lot of cases, the fine tuning that was once needed for these models is not necessary. You're better off with that combination of the language understanding comes from the model and the factual information comes from my data that I feed into the model through this retrieval augmented generation process.
Yeah. And you still have that human in the loop to be importing that meta information, or to like be guiding the AI so that it's producing the right outputs for your company.
And it can be really, I think you make a really good point about that, because there is a human in the loop, but sometimes that human role differs. And so understanding the human role can be, again, an important part of building both your application and the overall the operations around your application. Right.
So right.
Like Mike was saying, like if you're generating like important marketing content that you're going to, you know, pay to run in media, you're going to have a person look at every single piece of that before it goes out the door. If you're implementing a chatbot on your website to interact with your customers, it's not going to bring you much efficiency if somebody has to read the response every single time, right? So at that point, but the human is in the loop in the design process, in the testing process, making sure we think it's pointing to the right, you know, the current catalog of data, you know, who's doing some testing, who's designing that meta prompt to, you know, instruct the model to be accurate in its outputs, that sort of thing. So the human can sometimes be more in the design of the implementation and sometimes at the point of actually utilizing the output content.
And I just hop in.
Go ahead, Michael.
Sorry, just for a sec. I think Mary's, you know, great explanation of how the technology works is so important, right? A lot of times, you know, we customers will say, hey, you know, our legal team has all these legal questions for you, all these contractual questions. They want to understand the contracts. But really the conversation, yes, you should understand the contracts and you know, in our role, we're happy to explain the contracts and how they work. But it's also just as important or more important to understand, particularly in this context, to understand how the technology works, to understand that the, you know, the foundational models don't change. And so therefore, the language that you share with the foundational models is not, you know, going back to, or over to your competitor. It doesn't, both from a technical perspective, we also make that contractual promise, but it's, you know, it's important to understand both.
So, and before we keep going, I do have a question I want to ask here, which is, you know, as I'm hearing you both describe this, and I'm thinking about this from the perspective of the retail executive watching this conversation, right? And we've talked about a few use cases already for AI. We've talked about two really in particular. Am I correct in assuming that, you know, if I'm thinking of implementing AI in a specific process in my retail organization, that I should have somebody running point who is accountable for the application of that generative AI day in and day out? Or does it more depend on the use case? Like, how do you think about that? Mary, I saw you shaking your head. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I think, you know, it goes a little bit back to our earlier conversation about the governance, like that responsible AI is really about having a good governance process,
right?
That you do want to be thinking intentionally about how you're using these technologies so that you do know what are the applications we're making available, which ones are internal facing for our own employees, and if it's internal facing, then maybe the important thing we need to do is train our employees about this is the
appropriate. And who owns that training or who's responsible for that, right?
Some of them are more customer facing. Okay, who's on point if there's an incident that happens, if it generates a response that goes off the rails a little bit, which again, we think there's a lot of ways to make that not happen, but being prepared and anticipating, you know, what might happen. But yeah, I think we are big believers. And sometimes we do have conversations with customers who are, they're sort of like, reassure me that I never have to think that I can just use this without thinking about it. And our response is, well, not really.
Like
in terms of sharing our learning, we have learned that having a governance process, and it is an additional layer, and it is, you know, a process. But again, once you build the structure for it, you actually, again, you can feel so much more confident because you know you thought through the issues, you anticipated the risks, you deployed the technical mitigations that you've learned are the most appropriate for the specific use cases. So,
and as you're saying that, that means there's going to be new jobs that develop out of this or new responsibilities in the organization too. Like I'm thinking like the target days and like captainships, like there could be an AI captain, you know, across the different divisions, across the different, you know, organizational structures. So that is going to come from this, which is something I've never thought about until just now as we're having this conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it's similar to like the early days of mobile. Like you had a whole team that was focused on the mobile executions that were going out from your, like, or digital even, like from the print side to the digital side, like every time we have one of these iterations with technology, it does require another team. It's sounding like it's great to hear that sentiment, Mary. I want to dive into the last two points too. The last two areas we wanted to cover. The next one is post-purchase. Retailers have been using Gen AI to aid in follow-up conversations that, you know, are keeping the customers engaged after the purchase happens. So sometimes this is done via chatbot. There's other ways to really personalize that experience based on what the consumers purchased. But Michael, what's important for brands and retailers to know here for these particular use cases?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to use an example here of a customer that we've worked with recently, and that's CarMax, right? And CarMax used Azure OpenAI really to go back and look at their customer reviews and their customer feedback.
Okay.
So, you know, all of that content had sort of been generated post-purchase. They had a lot of it, and they went through and used Azure OpenAI to aggregate and to summarize, really to find the little jewels, right, within all of those customer reviews. And they use that to then create sort of new product descriptions or even better content, you know, for use both in the post-purchase, but also in the pre-purchase scenario. So like you say, I mean, there are a lot, that's just one example. There are a lot of similar use cases. We see folks using generative AI in a post-purchase scenario via the chatbot, as you say, right? A lot of people have questions after they purchase. How do I turn it on? Where do I put the batteries? You know, what do I do? Another common use case is really sort of scheduling installation, right? And again, that might be something, an application that gets installed on a computer or a kiosk in a store, in the mall. It could be in the chatbot afterward, right? And a lot of these little scenarios are ones where, where is the human in the loop, right? You probably need less of a human in the loop in these scenarios. There might be one for, you know, say who's on call for escalations or what have you. I think the interesting point about the first use case that I talked about the, you know, summarizing user reviews and feedback, is that the estimate was that the work that Azure OpenAI was able to do would have taken one person 11 years to do, right? And the generative AI system was able to do it in a week. So again, if you're not going to have a human in the loop in this situation, you have to think, okay, so how am I going to manage, you know, how these systems work? And again, as Mary has said, and some of her previous descriptions, you look at, okay, well, I'm probably going to use content filters here, right, to make certain that say that there's no, you know, foul or obscene language, you know, going back and forth. You may have a meta prompt which says, you know, only schedule a time if there is a time available, or, you know, only give an answer if if the answer is accurate. Do not make up an answer. There's lots of different, you know, ways that you operate without a human in the loop. I think in this case, we're also, you know, we're talking about the use of personal data, about customer data. And so it's really making certain that you're following your internal policies or, you know, the regulations in your jurisdiction around the use of personal data, around the use of following up and sort of, you know, contacting a customer and that they've agreed to allow you to do that, right?
Right.
So it's sort of a lot of the same questions that we would ask otherwise, right? Even if we were planning a marketing campaign or, you know, it's just, in this case, we're doing it post-purchase. One of the, just going back one conversation we were talking about, and Chris, you suggested, well, maybe we need, a new AI team. And you may. But also what you can do is, you know, sort of this AI governance, this, you know, identifying mitigations that can also be implemented into existing work streams that you have already, right? You may already have a privacy SME. You may already have a security SME. They may just be putting on, you know, a new hat. So it might be new, but it may not be, right? It's again, it's a bit of a balance, and it depends on the use cases that you're implementing.
Yeah, and even as you're talking about it, I think that's why the customer service use case seems like a one that people are more apt to get on board with, because it feels like that structure already exists for the escalations, the oversight, you know, in terms of how those chatbots, might be working as well. So like that can kind of be like a second hat you wear versus having a whole team that you need to devote to this new process. So, all right, well, let's close it up. So we promised the audience 4, so we're not going to disappoint. We always live up to our promises. And so the one use case that we saved till the end, because we hear about it a lot, but it's always a little bit nebulous for us too. Marian, we're going to go to you on this one, is supply chain and operations. What are some of the dynamics there that the audience should be thinking about?
Yeah. I think, well, you can see in the supply chain, we get to build on some of the blocks that we've already sort of discussed, some of the capabilities that we've already talked about. So, for example, Mike just talked about the ability of these technologies these models to summarize content, right? So, for example, Microsoft has added Copilot features to our Microsoft Supply Chain Center product. And they look across relevant kind of news sources and summarize key information that might have a supply chain impact based on information that's already within that supply chain center product to understand. They already understand some things about what your supply chains look like. And so that allows the models to look across relevant news sources, summarize the information. So it's just, again, using that language understanding to bring this layer of efficiency, summarize that information, surface it within a module that goes to a supply chain planner, and then identify the relevant suppliers who might be affected, and even draft the initial draft of an email communication that might go to one of those suppliers and say, hey, it looks like there's bad weather coming in. Is that going to affect the shipment that we're expecting on X date? And it can tap into those data sources. But then the language model, what it's doing is, like I said, the summary and the generation of the content in the form of this draft email. And then again, that's one where you'll want to pay attention to the human in the loop there, because decisions about your supply chain, you know, you can, certain things can be automated, right? Like automating that process of looking for issues, right? You could do, but you maybe don't want to automate the like email that goes to your supplier and says, hey, cancel that order. I'm going to send it to another, right? Because that's like a pretty nasty gram decision, right? So you'd want to make sure there's a good human in the loop there. But that's just one example of where, again, this ability to consume a lot of text content and summarize it and then match it up to other information is the capability that, you know, if you understand the supply chain space, you can start thinking about where you might apply that to bring some efficiencies into that process.
I love these examples, Chris.
Yeah, like, they're great. So, I didn't think about that before. I never thought about that.
It's so wonderful to just have your insight here, especially because, like Chris said at the beginning, I mean, you both have been working in this longer than the majority of the audience has, I'm certain, and Chris and I as well. But I'm wondering, you know, as we close out the conversation, if we look back at all of the applications we discussed today, what would you each say is kind of the biggest takeaway that you hope the audience got from this? Like your quick soundbite, what is it that you want them to leave with? Michael, I'm going to go to you first, and then Mary, we'll hear what yours is second.
Yeah, great question. I think part of it is, you know, don't be scared by the technology, but be deliberate in your use of the technology. You know, have a governance process. It doesn't have to be overly complicated, but, you know, really start by You know, identifying what are your use cases going to be, and at the same time, think about your governance process, right? And maybe you start by developing them together. And once you have sort of that governance process, you can, one, be comforted by it, but also use that to track what you're doing internally. And I think that, you know, that really can give a lot of the safety and comfort that people are looking for. Right. But really, you know, ask questions, ask, you know, people like ourselves or who you work with, you know, ask how the technology works, right? And I think it really, it goes a long way and will give a lot of comfort.
Yeah, lean on your partners who've been doing this, who've established some documentation, some templates, who have lawyers dedicated to each team within their organization for these kinds of things. Mary, close us out, quick soundbite on what you hope the audience is taking away today.
Again, I think understanding the basics of the technology and some of those core mitigation techniques that you can be taking advantage of. And we talked about four today: data grounding or retrieval augmented generation, if you want to be a real nerd. Ooh. Meta prompts, content filters, and human in the loop. Think about that, you know, understand those, deploy them wisely. And then I'm just going to add one more, which is the learn from others, you know, take advantage of the resources and tools that are out there.
Right. This has been so great. I mean, Anne, this podcast this webinar has run longer than typical, but I think that's because it's been so good. There's been so much that I've learned from this conversation that I think we're going to have you guys back too. Like, I could keep you guys on here for another hour and a half. Right. I know. But yeah.
We want every billable minute, Chris, billable minute we're going to take advantage of during this session.
Right. Yeah. And they were pretty succinct too. Yeah. So nice job. But no, I mean, the words I took from this were the key points I would emphasize for the audience too, is don't be afraid, but do be deliberate. I thought, Michael, the deliberate word is what was sticking in my head throughout listening to both of you speak today. It's like, there are great opportunities here at retailers' fingertips. You just have to be deliberate in your approach to where you want to go and find them first. And so that's kind of our calling card here for Anne and myself as we summarize this up. All right, we mentioned it at the outset, but let's just hit it again one more time. There's a lot of ways people can learn from Microsoft and its approach to using AI responsibly. Mary, where are some of those resources and how can our audience find them?
Yeah, we're going to provide some links to be included in the chat. Microsoft has a responsible AI kind of landing page. If you just search Microsoft responsible AI, you will get to this main page where we make available our responsible AI standard playbook, some other important resources. And then we've got some other materials that we'll provide links to. And then you can find Michael and I on LinkedIn if you want to reach out to us. But really, those going out to those resources that have already been built out is probably going to get you a faster answer. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you both for being here again. That's Mary Newcomer Williams and Michael Brick of Microsoft. Thank you both for sitting down with us. And thanks to all of you who joined us live on LinkedIn and asked your questions. And as always, on behalf of all of us at OmniTalk, be careful out there.